On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
People say, oh, well, artisanal food is all fancy and it's expensive and whatnot. It may be a little bit more expensive, but artisanal food is also saving the American city, you know, in many ways.
That's LA Magazine food critic Patrick Q talking about how the artisanal food movement has really taken hold in this country. He has a new book out called Finding the Flavors We Lost, From Bread to Bourbon, How Artisans Reclaimed American Food. At some point, about 10 years ago, the number of foods I started making myself quadrupled. Bread, always. But now vinegar, yogurt, jams, hot sauce, canned tomatoes, and tomato sauce. And I know I'm not alone. The word artisanal implies a forgotten craft. But is it real? Or just a marketing trend?
So I was very taken with the idea of what makes an American artisan? Because we all know the term itself, artisan, 20 years ago, unless you were selling hand-punched leather belts at a craft fair, that was an artisan. It slowly became part of our ideal of food. And I sort of wanted to pursue, how did Americans who didn't have a guild system, didn't have an apprenticeship system, often had grown up without examples of great artisanal food themselves, how do they decide to launch into this very demanding undertaking? Because as we all know, it's one thing to make something, whether it's bread, cheese, beer, vinegar, and it's another thing to make it excellently and to be sort of driven by this idea of excellence. And it's very much the drive of an artisan, a real artisan.
What intrigues me too when you pose that question is the idea of pre and post internet. Because one hears stories about lonely American cheesemakers wandering in the American cheese desert of the late part of the 20th century until they found another lonely cheese artisan.
You know, without the self-addressed stamped envelope, we probably would not have artisanal food in this country today. And while I was writing this book on the artisanal movement, particularly with sort of the back-to-the-landers of the 60s and 70s who I interviewed extensively, it was very much what you're saying is, I want to make cheese, let's say. How on earth do you make cheese? And you know, so you had to track down the person who just found out a tiny bit more than you had. And, you know, they would have a P.O. box somewhere and you would send the $5 in your self-addressed stamped envelope. And eventually, weeks later, the knowledge would return to you. This network of knowledge exchange created real bonds between the person also that the internet doesn't offer. So it had its hard aspects, but it really had powerful, strong ones too.
Were there key people or key communities that were poised when the internet happened to sort of explode out, proliferate faster than others?
Well, I'm thinking of one person particularly, Ricky Carroll, who's a sort of legendary person in cheesemaking circles. She and her friends had a sort of commune in Asheville, Massachusetts. They had to figure out a way to keep this big house that they'd bought, and they decided to learn to make cheese. As they were learning themselves, they said, well, why don't we put a little ad in the Dairy Goat Journal and see if anybody else is interested? And they went off on a trip to learn how to make cheese in Europe. And when they returned to Asheville, their post office box was full of requests. And suddenly they had to come up with a kit. So they went to a fabric factory to get cheesecloth, and they would cut it into strips, and they'd go to drugstores that still sold Renner tablets. This was the first Ricky Carroll cheese kit. So Ricky was well established when the internet took over, but I think she would be the first to say it has helped her enormously. But the foundation was there already. The kit would be bundled with scrunched up pages of the Asheville News and the local newspaper, and they're good. It would arrive. Cheesecloth, Renner tablets, acidifying culture, something to cut the curds, some instructions. And a couple of years later, they had a cheese press also. And that was your kit. And when you received that, you could transform a gallon of milk in your home kitchen into cheese.
Did the international slow food movement have a role in creating a greater desire to start to make things to, you know, not just back to the Landers, but I'm thinking about all the people who started traveling and then coming back and realizing that if they wanted these special products, they had to create them themselves.
I'm not quite sure of the dates, but the artisanal food movement, I think, was pretty well established by the time the slow food movement became a term, an understanding of food within this country. What the slow food movement certainly did was represent the highest standards of artisanal food. And those artisans might not even call themselves artisans. You know, some of the sheep's milk cheeses of Sardinia, they would just say it's cheese. But it certainly gave us an idea of, wow, that's what we're aiming for. And I think what really is, in terms of technology, just pictures pinging between phones, we can suddenly see, wow, that is what I'm aiming for. And, you know, in an Instagram feed, it gives us the standards that we're sort of aiming for in artisanal foods, yeah.
I would love you to talk about the development of the language and marketing of artisanal food, and in particular, the role played by Ari's Weinzweig from Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I wanted to sort of go upriver in every aspect of artisanal food, and one of them was sales. I decided to take Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, a sort of college town deli, started in 1982, as how did they suddenly start selling foods that often people didn't know about, and to give people reasons to buy them? Because in today's artisanal market, the story is very important. As Ari would say himself, you know, we had to give people reasons why it costs a little bit more. So the human element or facts were very important. They very much went with facts. If it was a herd of 12 Swiss cows that were making that milk, they were going to tell you it was a herd of 12 Swiss cows. If it was made in small amounts, because size was sort of the differentiator with big food, homogenized food, general mills, they were going to highlight the small amount of food that was made. They were extremely conscious of making the food accessible, because the conversation about gastronomic products, up until then, it was there to impress you with its sophistication. It was, the word imported was a key word, you know, not local, imported. What they did was they very much lowered the temperature, said, this is something that you can understand. You'll get this flavor. And the moment you walked into Zingerman's, they gave you a sample. They very much wanted you to taste it. And this was very different from how foods were sold before. The sample, my goodness, you know, that was considered stealing by the store owner. The faux sophistication that was wrapped all around, particularly cheese and wine, Zingerman's did away with it. And of course, it was very interesting. They couldn't get deliveries from the big cheese distributors. For them, it was a college town sandwich shop. It wasn't worth the time to send the truck. So Ari was very funny about how he had to develop his own network of purchasing the cheeses, which often meant going to the cheesemaker themselves or the bread maker themselves. But I think sales is a key part of the artisanal conversation, because often today it's oversimplified to only small is good. And, you know, there's this whole conversation about, well, we're tiny and we're micro and we're nano. And I feel it's sort of missing part of the great achievement of artisanal food, which is to have created not just a parallel way of eating, but a parallel economy that's creating jobs, opportunities, redefining American cities, keeping agricultural jobs, you know, in the countryside. And so there's many things that artisanal food has done, which I feel saying, well, only small is real artisanal. It oversimplifies the discussion, I feel.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you read stories about struggling urban cores that are ripe for a reset, almost the first thing you see come is like an artisanal grocery or a highly curated coffee shop.
You're exactly right, Evan. I was so struck by that. This book, I didn't want it just to be sort of Vermont and Sonoma. I wanted it to be about the entire country. So I traveled extensively. I remember being in the Walker's Point neighborhood of Milwaukee. It was all industrial warehouses, sort of the Rust Belt that had seen industry decimated. And now that entire neighborhood, the cobble streets, the red brick buildings, coffee roasters, a creamery, a distillery, two breweries, a chocolatier, full of people strolling around. And one of the cheesemakers I profiled, Orb Weaver Farm in Vermont, two women back to the Landers, worked for 40 years making cheese. And they've just donated 300 acres in the Champlain Valley to the Vermont Land Trust, so it will always remain agricultural. You know, people say, well, it costs a bit more. And, you know, I feel like saying, well, you know, next time you're driving up the Champlain Valley and you have an unobstructed view of the Green Mountains, you know, ask yourself, was that cheese worth the extra 50 cents a pound? You know, these are sort of parts of the conversation, too.
And also the thing that I find pretty extraordinary about our country is that all of these links were broken. Mm. The people who decided to have the hubris to say, how do we make this cheese? I mean, they were really starting from nowhere, from zero, from scratch.
They were starting from scratch. The link had been broken, and deficiencies of industrially produced food had destroyed those links. One of the ways I sort of traced that loss was in charitable cookbooks put out by church groups in 1860 to about 1950 that usually women of the community would put together for a good cause, like a church roof or missiles or things like that. In sort of 1895, a charitable cookbook, a home recipe would be wilted dandelion greens with soda cracker gravy for boiled veal. And I remember reading that recipe and saying, my goodness, in any great restaurant today, if you saw that on the menu, you'd say, oh, fantastic, this is so contemporary. By 1955, how many charitable cookbooks were five-can casserole? How many recipes have I read for five-can casserole in the 1950s? And you say, wow, our food was so vital, so connected to a place, to a tradition. How did we lose that?
So let me ask you then the role of chefs. Mm. It's only fairly recently that I've noticed in restaurants that this desire to make things and make condiments and whatever has really entered into every serious restaurant.
Yeah.
They're not buying anything. They're making their own ice cream, pasta, ketchup, yeah, mustard. You decided to put your Southern California focus on Nancy Silverton of Liberia Bakery, Carlos Salgado of Taco Maria, and Food Forward's Rick Namias. Why?
Well, I saw in them very representative characters of different aspects of what's going on in the artisanal food. Nancy Silverton, certainly when she was starting La Brea Bakery in 1988, was the epitome of the self-taught artisan. And, you know, she was in this little rented kitchen space off Venice Boulevard in Culver City, and it was her, the flour, the mixer, and the oven. And she was going to come out of there either an artisan or the dream was up. Rick Namias of Food Forward was, you know, this incredible organization of urban gleaning, was very much attached to the idea of self-sufficiency, which, let's remember that all this pickling, all this curing was about not allowing food go to waste. So it's wonderful to see a modern group, contemporary group, responding to those very old motivations for being a food artisan. Yes, chefs were key in this, and Carlos Salgado of Taco Maria represented really a chef who's taken an ingredient, in his case, land-raised corn, grown in milpas, small checkerboard fields in Mexico, and becoming sort of fascinated by it and honoring it on his menu, Taco Maria in Costa Mesa. And there is this element of honoring an ingredient that a chef can do in a way that just a home cook can't. When a chef puts a cheesemaker's name on their cheese list, that is such a huge validation for that cheesemaker. Also, the economic aspects of it, when a chef can buy an entire wheel of cheese or two, that might represent 2 months of selling tiny wedges at the farmer's market. And I didn't want to leave chefs out of the discussion because, yes, we all go to a restaurant and we say, does everything have to be homemade? Or, you know, is the ketchup actually better than Heinz's ketchup? You know, these questions are perfectly valid. But there is an element, as things become more and more mechanized, that the skill of the human hand, which is at the root of the artisanal undertaking, is being celebrated. So even when I see artisan everywhere on a menu, ultimately, I think this is a wonderful thing that has occurred.
That's LA Magazine food critic Patrick Q. If you're in LA, head to the Last Bookstore on Monday to meet Patrick in person. He'll be talking to Chef Joseph Centeno, a marvelous chef, about, you guessed it, artisanal food. Find details on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we consider a case of hive heists and stolen honeybees. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Conjure up an image of a burglar. The last thing you'd probably imagine is a man completely covered in a white beekeeper suit, including netted headgear, tiptoeing across a field in the dead of night. But beehives are a hot commodity, and hive theft has become a serious issue in California almond orchards, where bees are needed to pollinate 800,000 acres of trees. The trees need to be pollinated so there's enough almonds to supply 82% of the planet. Jody Helmer's a beekeeper in North Carolina who's covering, wait for it, the increased occurrence of hive heists. Could you explain the role of the bee broker and why they're bringing hives into the state?
Absolutely. So there are not enough beehives in California alone to pollinate the almond trees. So what happens is there are commercial beekeepers around the country who manage hundreds and sometimes thousands of hives in their bee yards. And bee brokers coordinate relationships between the almond growers and the beekeepers to transport these hives from out of state into California to pollinate these almond trees. And this happens typically between December and March every year. And without them, there would just not be enough bees or beehives to do the pollination.
This issue of colony collapse and the subsequent decline of bee populations, has it increased the value of a single hive?
That's exactly what's happening. So, you know, for example, in 2010, beekeepers were paid about $130 for every hive they sent out to pollinate the almond orchards. And this year, they were paid $200 per hive. So the value has definitely gone up.
What fascinates me about all this, too, is the distribution, the idea that all of these hives are on the roads,
right,
going and coming back. It's an amazing image. The fact that people are going in the dead of night and stealing these, aside from being a criminal activity, it sounds really dangerous for someone who doesn't already know about bees and how to handle them.
Right. So I'm a beekeeper, a very small hobbyist beekeeper here in North Carolina, and it actually never occurred to me that my hive might be in any danger from theft because, as you would imagine, not anyone wants to just grab a box full of stinging insects and make off with it. And for that reason, it's believed by the sheriff's departments that are investigating these crimes and the bee brokers and a lot of the national and state level bee associations that these are actually beekeepers who are doing this stealing.
Oh, that's so sad.
It's very sad.
Are they then turning around and renting them out to other orchards?
That's exactly what's happening. So they are doing a couple of things, allegedly. So very few beekeepers have their hives marked. So some people brand them or put plaques on them to indicate that a hive belongs to a certain apiary, but most beekeepers do not do that. And so when the hives are stolen, even if they are branded, what's happening is the beekeepers are taking out the frames, which are the sort of racks, if you will, that have the bees and the honey in them, and they're putting them in new hive bodies or boxes. So it's impossible to tell your bees from my bees from the bees that belong to the guy down the street. So either they're stealing the hives and then putting the frames into new boxes and passing them off as their own, or if the hive bodies, the hives are unbranded or unmarked, they're just taking those hives and either giving them to bee brokers or giving them to almond farmers for pollination and passing them off as their own.
So the victims here are the orchards and the brokers who have already paid for those hives and have put them in place, and the original beekeepers, correct?
The victim really is the beekeeper, because the almond farmer still gets the hive for pollination because he or she doesn't realize that it's stolen. And the bee broker is still able to fulfill their contracts because they often don't realize that the hive is stolen. So it's really the beekeeper that suffers. Although bee brokers and almond farmers are not in any way condoning this behavior. And in fact, some almond farmers have gone as far as to hire security to protect these hives. But if you want to look at it a different way, consumers are going to suffer too, because as these hives get more expensive, almond farmers are going to be forced to pay more to have beehives to pollinate their orchards. And so it could be argued that the price of almonds may go up. And as hive numbers decrease and the risk increases, there's a potential that beekeepers, commercial beekeepers, may get out of this altogether because there's just no way to protect themselves. So you may not be able to find almonds, or you may have to pay a very, very handsome price for them.
I want to talk for a minute about the security, how the hives are being protected. Are we talking about security patrolling with guns in orchards?
You know, I would say that every farmer does it a little differently. So in some cases, there's no security at all. And in some cases, they have hired security personnel to patrol the orchards. Whether or not they have guns, I can't speak to that specifically. But it's just a difficult thing to do, given that, you know, these are very rural areas in the very dark of night that stretch across vast amounts of land.
Do they think that the thieves are individuals, or is it organized?
It's a little bit of both. So when I originally reported this story for NPR's blog, The Salt, I talked to a detective in Butte County who had just prosecuted a thief who stole 64 hives. He was convicted, and he acted alone. In other cases, there was a member of the House of Representatives in Iowa who actually has a part-time business running a honey company, and he had his hives on the property of a local business, and they caught two men pulling up in a truck and stealing those hives. So it just really depends. With smaller numbers of hives, it's often a single person. And in Butte County alone, for example, there were several hundred hives stolen at a time. That definitely requires a more organized effort. You know, beehives are very heavy, and to move that number of hives in a, you know, reasonably short period of time to avoid detection, you need some manpower for sure.
That's beekeeper Jody Helmer. Go to our website for a link to the piece she wrote on hive thievery for NPR's The Salt blog. Now it's time for more buzz on the Market Report. Too much? Well, let's see what Laura Avery's got in store for us this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm happy today to be talking with Walter Greenwood, who's the executive chef at 1212 Santa Monica, literally steps away from the farmer's market. And Walter, you're here at the market today. Your restaurant just opened a couple months ago, did you say?
That's correct. We've been open for about 2 months now.
Brand new, on the promenade, a block from the market, and you are making a delicious summer dish. What are you shopping for today?
So today we're out here shopping for watermelon, amongst other things. We're doing this awesome seasonal gazpacho at the restaurant. It's summertime. Things are heating up here in Santa Monica. So we're right by the beach. This is a perfect dish for people to come and enjoy, cool off a little bit. So we're going to go to the Munich Ranch Chint, pick up some fresh watermelon.
Right. And when you say gazpacho, that's, I think that's sort of a soup, isn't it?
It is. It's normally a chilled soup made with vegetables or fruit. So our twist on it, we're doing a watermelon gazpacho with heirloom cherry tomatoes that we find here at the farmer's market, cucumber, a little bit of normally some type of hot pepper that we can find at the farmer's market to bring in some heat. Really tie the dish together.
Right, right, right. And so the watermelon inspiration just came because we had a heat wave?
Somewhat, you know, and I was thinking, you know, the menu that we built is somewhat definitely seasonal. So I said, what a perfect dish, you know, for the beach. And what's funny is growing up as a kid, I used to live on the beach in South Texas. And I remember my father, you know, about 5 years old, and he says, let's grow some watermelon. Throw seeds out in the sand off the beach. I said, you know, Dad, you're crazy. These aren't going to grow. We need soil. Sure enough, a couple months later, we have watermelons popping up on the beach. And this is one of the first times I actually ever had gazpacho when my mother made it.
Out of watermelon?
Out of watermelon, yes.
Sort of a Johnny Appleseed of the Texas coast.
I guess so.
Yeah, and when you say watermelon, I mean, summer is here. There are watermelons galore. And looking at it from the outside, I know we've got orange flesh, yellow flesh, red flesh, seeds, no seeds. How do you pick your watermelon?
For this, ideally, I like to find something with the least amount of seeds because we do puree this. Normally, I look for a bright red for the color because I want that bright red broth, you know, to really stand out. And then we go and we grab the cherry heirloom tomatoes. So we have the yellow, the green, the purple floating through.
Do the tomatoes kind of float on top or are they pureed as well?
No, the tomatoes, well, what we do is I will puree some nice vine ripe tomatoes, okay, to get that flavor, nice balance with the sweetness and the savory. But when it comes to the heirloom cherry tomatoes, we just slice those in half and let them soak up the juice. And those are presented not pureed. And this is something that we'll be changing, though, at the restaurant. I'm walking around the farmer's market, got some beautiful white peaches. So maybe next week we're going to roll out a white peach gazpacho. So definitely come try it out.
Highly adaptable to the season. Yeah, you could almost eat it for breakfast.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah, right. That sounds so great. And I love the idea of you coming back to the market every week and just throwing in a different fruit and building it around a whole different fruit as the season progresses.
Of course. And like I said, you know, just to have the market at my back door, it has been it's been a blast for me and my staff. You know, sometimes we grab some of the cooks, bring them out here, and we're just having fun with it. And that's what our menu is based off of.
That's really good to hear. All right, Walter. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Laura.
That was Walter Greenwood. He's the executive chef at 1212 Santa Monica, and he's embracing the market and the beach, and I feel like following back to the restaurant right now and having a cup of that gazpacho. You know, we have a lot of watermelons at the farmer's market this summer. The ones that Walter was talking about are grown by Munich Ranch. Munich is up in Paso Robles. Ed Munich, he's one of our longtime farmers here. He's been coming to the market for well over 25 years. And today I'm talking with, I would have to call you a third generation Munich Ranch person. It's Victor Gomez. His dad, Hugo, has worked for the Munichs for years.
Correct.
Victor and his brother, Jesus, work for the farm now. And can you tell us, your watermelons are delicious. You have a line of people. How do you grow the watermelons? What variety are they? And why do they taste so good?
Well, our first crop starts in April. It's not too much cloudy skies. Cloudy skies bother them a lot. So we try to start when all the cloudy skies, fog and everything is gone. Mm-hmm. We grow seedless and seeded. So when we plant them, we need to plant two furrows of seedless, mm-hmm. one of seeded. So the bees make the pollinization between them.
Do you have beehives on the property?
We do. We do have bees. Especially close to the melons.
Yeah. Do they ever sting you?
Not yet, but they are used to once a year.
Everybody wants to know, how do you know when the watermelon is ripe?
My dad is an expert. He picks them. It's the sound. He's very familiar. When it's hollow, the sound, it means it's ready. But at the same time, they need to be heavy, so it means it's crispy.
A lot of water, so heavy for their size.
Yes,
yeah.
Correct.
Okay. So, Victor, we're going to have you tap on a ripe watermelon so we can hear what it sounds like, okay?
Okay, go.
Yes, this is the sound of a watermelon when it's ripe. The sounds go through the melon, and your fingers doesn't hurt. When it's unripe, your fingers will feel a little pain.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Do it again? Yeah, I hear that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and then when we get it home, how long can we keep it? And should we keep it in the refrigerator?
Well, it's up to you. You know, our watermelons can last for a good 2 weeks on the counter or on the table. But watermelon in the refrigerator tastes super good.
Okay, and they're a round watermelon. I think a lot of people think of a watermelon as being long like a football, but these seem to be more round.
Yeah, the round ones are the seedless. The ones like long like a giant cucumber are the seeded.
Oh.
Yes, that's the difference.
How long will your melons be in the market?
We're expecting a good season this year. So we're expecting from July through all September and hopefully 2 weeks of October with the best flavor.
All right, well, we just had a taste of your watermelon. It's absolutely, we had the seedless, delicious.
Yes, they are delicious and the seeded are just like a candy.
That was Victor Gomez. He's been working on the Munich Ranch probably, what, since you were a little boy?
Yes, since I've been working there for 11 years.
11 years. Yeah, and you can tell he loves the farm and he loves the fruit, and he's got very many happy customers here at the table right now. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Laura.
For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Find the recipe for watermelon gazpacho on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we travel to New York to break bread. Stay with us.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Bread, whether it's tall or flat, enriched with egg or unsalted, has historically been the center of community. This trinity of farmer, miller, and baker, well, it's the lifeblood of many cultures, and mills were often the epicenter of developing cities. In her quest to understand how the flour she used to make a perfect pancake ended up in her pantry, food and ag writer Amy Halloran decided to take a deep dive into local grain systems, starting in her home state of New York. When did the local millers start to disappear?
The centralization of grain production was really in the late 1800s as a number of advances in transportation, agricultural technology, and just railroads opening up new lands made it possible to have grain grown in central places, places that were farther away from population centers than they used to be.
And how many new ones are on the scene now and thriving?
It's really just a handful because, unlike other areas of re-regionalizing foods, this one is slow and you're going up against a bigger commodity than any other. And people have to build up land, labor, and infrastructure to get the grains growing in place, get the mills happening. It's not as cheap as, say, I'm going to grow some tomatoes. I don't want to reduce the work of that because I understand how hard it is to re-localize any food, but the layers of processing that have to happen for grains are much more difficult. So it's still just a handful of fantastic mills around the country.
So let's start with your investigation, that bag of flour that landed on your countertop. Where did it come from?
Well, first it came in a cookie. My husband is a tree surgeon, and he came home from hanging some lights in trees in Connecticut via a bakery where he got me an oatmeal chocolate ganache bar. And I was not very happy with just getting a cookie when he had a nice trip away. But that cookie opened up this whole world to me because the oats and the wheat were so flavorful. They stood up loud and clear against some really great butter and chocolate. And I thought, this is what I've been waiting for. I had these questions in my head of why we didn't grow grains and mill flour around us anymore. And I've always been a really avid baker. So along with that pivotal cookie that I so unfriendly received, I got a pamphlet that told me about a community grain project that was happening in the Hudson Valley. And as soon as I could, I went down to Wild Hive. It had a bakery at the time, and now they're just a mill. And I started to figure out more about what it takes to repopulate a regional grain economy.
That's really interesting to me that they stepped away from the retail aspect to concentrate on the fundamental milling aspect.
Yes, there are so many different approaches to this. And in this case, it was too much to have the baking when he was trying to help regrow the grain growing itself and get more people involved in that aspect. And now Wild Hive has flour in many restaurants, and Eataly New York City has breads that are made exclusively with Wild Hive. Not all their breads, because that would be a really tall order to get any single bakery making local flour, although that has happened. One of my favorite stories in all of this is a bakery called Red Hen Baking Company, and they are outside of Montpelier, Vermont, and they have managed to get 90% of their production run, which is 15,000 pounds of bread a week, is coming from within 150 miles. And it's just a great story of what can be achieved if someone puts their mind to it. The baker just really was curious about what can we do to localize flour. Here I am in Vermont, this rarefied food world. And he was involved in a lot of different efforts and met a lot of grain growers and millers and made the extraordinary happen.
When I look at this burgeoning scene, for me, the millers are really interesting people, because to step up and say, I want to buy a machine that costs thousands of dollars and often comes from Germany, for example, and then learn how to prepare the grain, store the grain, understand all the post-harvest issues, and then embark upon learning themselves how to mill everything, and then after this huge capital investment, go out and try and co-opt people who are used to just getting stuff sent in a bag, ready to throw into a bowl. I mean, that's like a very particular kind of personality.
I always look a little cross-eyed at the millers and think, why are you doing this? You know, with incredible fondness. You know, you can go to week-long courses on and to learn how to be a maltster and how to start a malt house. There's none of that for milling. You're just pulling all of this stuff from thin air, reading guidebooks from the late 1800s to figure out what different tools you can do and how you can set your stones and what sifting you might do. Not to mention the variety sourcing, which is the trickiest part. You know, this all begins with seeds, and to look for something that's going to be distinct and have beautiful expression, that all starts with going backwards to finding some seeds that are suited to the locale, something that's going to not necessarily compete with, the standard yields of what a grower's going to get otherwise, but it's going to compete flavor-wise so that the miller can charge a higher price for this very different product that people still think of as very, very anonymous.
Who are some of the leaders in this new regional grain movement?
Gristin Toll strikes me as a big leader. Nan Kohler is one of my flower heroes because of what she's doing to create these flowers of distinction. Nan does an excellent job of going out and trying to find grains that have really good characteristics. And before she even buys a grain to put into her product line, she experiments with a small quantity of it. So she understands it. A milling bakery in Vermont called Elmore Mountain Bread, I love that they're milling up at the top of this dirt road in Vermont, and they started making mills as well. So they're really so incredibly curious. I think that's the thing that is most intriguing about all of the people that I happen to meet, is they're so engaged with their processes and so curious about it. Of course, I'm a fan of Farmer Ground Flour, which is my closest mill, and I am really in love with their white pastry wheat flour and their spelt flour, which make competitively great pancakes.
How difficult is it to start to work with all of these fresh flours?
It depends on where you're coming from. You know, for a home baker, I don't think it's very tough if you are already used to whole grain. I think that's something I realized finally. You have to have some familiarity with how bran is going to behave in your baked good. Once you have that, then everything is easy.
Is there a next it grain that's on the horizon?
Oh my gosh, I think everybody has the potential for the next it grain. In all these corners of the United States, we're falling in love with the grains that have a story that appeals to its locale, but we've also fallen in love with stories that happen. So Red Fife, everybody wants Red Fife to grow where they are because it has a good legend to go along with it, or Turkey Red. While they will adapt to regions, we have our wheats. And so in New York, the researchers at Cornell and Green Market Regional Grains Project has been really involved in this kind of looking at stuff. My hopes is that something called Pride of Genesee, which is from the late 1800s, will be our it grain because it echoes our history with the Erie Canal, which not only opened up the western part of New York State for grain growing, but also opened up the United States for better grain lands beyond.
Amy, why don't you share with us the Erie Canal story?
Okay, so one of the first voices to have a very strong audience for being a proponent of the Erie Canal was a flour merchant named Jesse Howley. He largely used towpaths and mud paths to try to get grains to New York and went broke. So he ends up in debtor's prison. And while he's in debtor's prison, he decides to do something, and that is to push the idea of a canal. He knew the value that a canal would bring toward really developing the wilds of New York State. He knew that the farming ground in western New York was very, very good, less rocky. So he wrote all of these essays, signing them as Hercules, saying that we needed a canal. And DeWitt Clinton, who became the governor, used Jesse Howley's championing of the idea of having a canal across New York State to push this forward. And the canal was an engineering wonder. All of these great inventions went into making this channel for grains to be grown in western New York, come down, and also to open up then all the other potential for the grain belts that happened. It's a miraculous moment to me.
Amy Halloran's book is The New Breadbasket. Watch a video of Amy making her perfect pancake on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Whole wheat is cultivated worldwide, but industrialization has taken out both nutritional value and the wheat's actual taste. In Pasadena, California, one baker's trying to give wheat back its good name. Nan Kohler's flour mill is called Grist and Toll. So you're the first local mill in Los Angeles in how long?
About 100 years. It's been a while.
Wow, that's just so crazy.
It is, but what's really crazy and I think hard for people to wrap their heads around is that milling was key to establishing even a city like Los Angeles. The very first commercial building erected in LA was Capital Milling.
Which you can still see the name on the side of the building.
Yep.
In Chinatown.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
It's an enormous undertaking with a really steep learning curve. What inspired you to take it on?
At the heart of it, it's the desire of an artist to have more diversity, really looking under the microscope at that key ingredient, flour. My style as a baker was very diverse to begin with. I don't like big sugar bombs, things that are overtly sweet or cloying in any way. So I paid a lot of attention to different things in that process and was using a wide array of flours for my baking, buckwheat flour, oat flour, whole wheat pastry flour. And so for me, it was about flavor. And when I really started to kind of dig in and do major research, some of those key questions, do we grow wheat in California? Could I do milling on a smaller scale? The more I started to investigate and the more the response was, yes, you might be able to pull it off, the more I, with the heart of a baker, wanted to make it happen.
Did you have a moment where you saw someone else doing it in another city, perhaps, when you realized that it would really be possible?
No, it was a combination of things. I definitely spoke with other small-scale regional millers in different parts of the country. I went and visited two of them. I went to Maine Grains and saw Amber Lamke and her partner Michael on the East Coast. I hung out with Hayden Flour Mills in Arizona. What I find really interesting about this is there are literally only a handful of us as independent millers where the milling is the craft in the United States right now, and our business models are radically different, even though we all have this very unifying, overarching goal, which is we need more diversity in our wheat crops, we need to grow more sustainably, and we want a fresh and interesting product to work with.
Are all of you linked to the farm? Are all of you interested in local wheat? And is that sort of the driving force?
Yes, and it really is a combination of things. You can't have beautiful, fresh flour without that connection to the farm and where it's grown. I mean, everything for me begins and ends there with that product.
So are all the wheats that you sell at Grist and Toll from California?
Not yet. Much of what I mill is sourced from California. If not, it is West Coast. I buy occasionally from a certified organic female farmer in Arizona. I work with a couple of farmers over the border in Oregon, but it's largely California and those two satellite states.
Is it that the infrastructure doesn't exist because the local wheats have been kind of eviscerated?
Yes, when you don't have wheat spread out on much more farmland with big endeavors and small farming endeavors, all of those things like cleaning the wheat, trucking the wheat to and from places, storing and handling the wheat, those facilities and that equipment vanishes very quickly. And it's really difficult and very, very expensive to try to put all of those pieces back into place. So the more we get farmers on board with this idea of growing local wheat in Southern California, the more that's going to become a pretty big issue for us to overcome.
The wheat that you sell, give me an idea of the price range as opposed to commodity flour.
So commodity flour, what I compete with in the marketplace is the stone cold reality that most flour is wheat that is grown, harvested, cleaned, processed, turned into flour, bagged, and delivered for 35 to 25 cents a pound to a restaurant, to insert name of super cool hip place here. I can't even touch that if I want to buy direct from a farmer just for the basic cost of the wheat itself. So before it's cleaned, before it's handled for me, before it's trucked to me, before I have my add-on fixed costs of my rent and my labor and my equipment and everything else, I start at anywhere from 2 to 10 times just in the price of the wheat alone.
If I were to reach my hand into a bag of Gold Medal and reach my hand into a bag of Grist and Toll, what are the differences, the tactile differences and the sensual differences I'll detect?
Well, that is the crux of everything. And that is really what defines whether or not a business like mine or this idea of local wheat and local milling can even succeed. If I can't deliver to you a superior product that is obviously more interesting and more desirable to work with, more delicious, more aromatic, all of those things, no one's going to care. So when you dip your hand into that bag of Gold Medal, you'll feel a very fine, soft, refined, powdery texture. When you dip your hand into Grist and Toll, first of all, the aroma will be undeniable. So before you even put your hand in that bag, there's a pretty dramatic difference. It will still feel very fine and very powdery. I don't mill every wheat or grain the same way. I put my baker's cap on as a miller, and I also think that's very important. The milling is my craft, and I address every single grain with the eye of the end user, a home baker, a professional baker, a chef in a restaurant. And I think that's really critical to look at each one and the individual beauty and their idiosyncrasies, everything that comes along with that package. I can get an unbelievably fine, powdery texture, and I can fool people into thinking that's actually a refined flour when in many cases it's not.
I've noticed that your offerings sometimes seem like they're seasonal. Is that true?
Yes, I can't always get the same wheat. That was a very scary thing for me in the beginning, because when you are putting something out into the marketplace and you're competing with a very predictable product, the flour that we buy in the grocery store, is a mathematical equation. It's to be the same all day, every day. And some of the first questions I got from bakers specifically were, well, I'm going to order this flour next week. It's going to behave differently. It's going to be crazy. How can I have any sort of reliability from you? And the truth of the matter is, it won't always be reliable. It will be 100% reliable as long as I have that particular wheat in inventory, because it's my hands driving the mill. And when I've milled all of it, it's gone. And even if we plant those same varieties, it's not going to be on that same parcel. The climate will be different. The soil will be different. And that wheat with the same name, just like a wine grape or any other agricultural product, is going to be a little bit different. So it's up to me as the miller to understand what those differences are and to be able to educate the audience. What are you going to have to change? It might only be your hydration percentage for a sourdough loaf is going to have to be decreased 1% to 2%. It's not always such a crazy radical thing, but there will be differences. But I also think that's one of the great, great beauties of this kind of work.
If we want to bake, let's say, cookies with some of your flour, what type of flour should we look for when we see your brand somewhere? And what can we expect as a finished product that will be different?
The truth of the matter is, and people will either love me or hate me for this answer, you can bake a cookie with any flour in my shop, and each one will give you its own different expression of that grain and that end product. So in the end, it's all good. It's just your arc of creativity and what you want it to look and taste like. The most dramatic difference, the most aha moments tend to happen with the simpler baking applications. If you want to really taste wheat, make a biscuit. Make a shortbread cookie. Do 5 or 6 different batches with different types of wheat and grain. It is so illuminating. The texture will be melt in your mouth. You won't be expecting that. Our projection of whole wheat flour and wheat is so tiny and limited based on these horrible 100 years experience with an overprocessed product that it's pretty mind-blowing to have something delicate that melts on your tongue and is just packed with flavor. And the other really interesting thing is they don't always scream of wheat. Many times I suggest spelt or red fife. More of the heritage wheats have this beautiful roundness to them. And what they will do is anchor everything else and let everything else that's in that recipe, that cookie or that muffin, really bloom and shine. And you won't be able to put your finger on it. But it's the flour. It's the wheat. It's there helping everything else and providing richness and more interesting texture.
That's Nan Kohler of Grist and Toll. Find a link to a recipe for her whole grain berry shortcake on her website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. We close out the show in Koreatown at a restaurant devoted to the cult of bulgogi. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
Bulgogi is sort of the basic unit of Korean barbecue. It's grilled, thin, sliced beef.
That's our very own Jonathan Gold talking about bulgogi at Gwangyang in Koreatown.
The beef is usually marinated. I mean, when you go someplace and you get something that's Korean and they don't tell you what it is, it's probably going to be bulgogi. If you're getting, like, you know, Korean rice bowl, it's bulgogi. If you're going to, like, a picnic and everybody is bringing, like, foods from different parts of town, the Korean one is going to be bulgogi. It is the lingua franca. It is the absolute basic Korean barbecue.
Is this place doing a particular version?
Indeed, they are. In Seoul, Gwangyang is famous for, its uptown style of bulgogi. And all the meat that they use, at least in the L.A. location, is prime. So you have prime ribeye, you have prime tongue, whatever that is. You have, prime flour meat. You have prime bulgogi. Usually bulgogi is very marinated in soy, sugar, rice wine. There's always a little bit of pear. There's probably some sesame in there. And you get this sort of sweetness, you get caramelization if you're lucky. The meat is usually pretty tough and uninteresting, but the flavor is good. You're happy. It's what you came for. They've figured out a way of doing it so that the bulgogi has this almost supernal tenderness to it. It just dissolves in your mouth. Nobody will tell you what they marinate it with, and everyone will give you like a little bit of clue. It says, well, I think there's pears involved. There might be Korean apples. And somebody else will say, well, I know there's a bottle of sesame oil. Everybody's very coy about it, but it's great. I should probably say there's two different kinds of bulgogi on the menu. There is what they call LA-style bulgogi, which is the one that you're used to more or less. And then there's the one where you have to sort of gird yourself to say Gangnam style.
Okay, so you order the Gangnam style.
Right.
And then what comes?
It's just a plate of meat, and they come out and they spread it out and it cooks, and then they turn it and it cooks, and they push it to the side, and you eat it. I mean, there are slivered scallions and dressed bean sprouts to eat it with if you want to. The bean paste that usually comes with it.
So what's the difference between the LA and the Gangnam style?
One is marinated for a lot longer in a much sweeter medium that has a lot of soy in it, and the other looks unmarinated, but it's subtly
It's more
marinated.
Purist.
Yeah, it's more purist. As at any Korean barbecue restaurant, there are the banchan, the small side dishes that show up, pots of steamed egg, kimchi, pickled radish stems, little cubes of cold omelet, cold fish. The kimchi pancake is really nice, sort of puffy and crisp. The seafood pancake also. It's nice when they put it on top of a bed of genep leaves, sometimes translated sesame leaf, though it has nothing to do with sesame. But it has that particular pungency that I think is the soul of Korean cooking. And they have one of the better versions in town of yukgwe, which is that dish of almost frozen slivered beef with crunchy Korean pear, a little bit of sesame oil, a little bit of salt, and an unusual shot of chili here. Usually there's not so much chili. It's just this totally luxurious beef tartare experience with the crunch of the pear. It's delicious.
It's kind of like Korean carpaccio.
Yeah. And Gangyang uses exceptionally good meat, so the quality of it is excellent. I mean, I also love the one at Parks Barbecue a few blocks away, but this is up there with it.
Wow. Is this an indication of a new sort of filling in at the top of Korean restaurants in town?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it had always been my theory that Parks Barbecue established the top, and there were always a lot of places in the middle that were just okay. We started to see a lot of all-you-can-eat places that were a bit less than just okay. But, obviously got a huge amount of meat for not that much money. With this at the top, I think you'd have to include Baekjeong as at a restaurant very close to the top. They use great meat. And there's a couple other places that maybe we are seeing the elegant style of Korean barbecue come into fore.
If we're coming to this restaurant, are we just going to eat the bulgogi, or are there other cuts or other dishes we should check out?
The galbi is great. It comes out as a beautiful steak that they put on the grill, and then they cook, and at some point they cut it up so it caramelizes and dole it out to everybody, and you dip that into sesame and salt.
Jonathan Gold's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Gwangyang in Koreatown. Text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations.
Well, that's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com. You can also find Good Food On Demand on KCRW's and many, many other mobile apps. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Messiah, and Pete Bloomberg. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.